And we're back.
And it is the Linux Show for May the 4th, 2004. We are back, giving you another episode of the weekly edition of the Linux Show. And we have most of the panel with us so far, at least, tonight. We're trying to track down Doc Searles. He's around somewhere. We're not just exactly sure where. We'll try and track him down before the show gets too far down, though. We just moments ago gave him a page, but we'll see what happens. The rest of the panel is here tonight. How are you doing tonight, Arnie?
Doing fine.
Are you surviving the record heats and now fires?
Oh, well, the fires aren't too bad, but the record heat is going on. I've got the air conditioning going here. Maybe you can hear it howling away.
Yeah, sure can.
Yeah, it's I'll turn it off in a little bit because it's cooling off. So, it's very, very warm, and we're waiting for the June gloom to come along and cool things off.
Yeah. What's June gloom?
That's where the winds come in from the ocean and make everything cloudy and gloomy and cool. And then July and August are a bitch. They're hot.
But it's a dry heat, right?
Yeah, well, right now the wind's coming from the desert, so we're getting all the heat.
Yep.
Well, this is a desert, so, you know, what can I say?
Yep. Well, according to NBC, it won't be a desert much longer with California falling into the ocean.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you know, of course.
You'll be set.
Yeah, well, you know, that's unfortunate. The place where they're predicting those earthquakes before this fall is exactly where I'm sitting right now.
So you'll be living at beachfront property.
Right, after that, if you wait a few million years, a few hundred million years, you'll have nice, cool real estate at the bottom of the Alaska Trench.
That's it. Yeah. Yeah, we could go, and I won't have to spend all that money to go on the Inside Passage.
Geez, Eric Estrada going to be around selling crappy real estate up there next?
Yeah, that's it.
They might have wrapped up the SCO lawsuit by then, maybe.
Well, if we're lucky.
Yeah. Well, yeah, speaking of SCO, I have a solution to the SCO situation, but we'll discuss that a little bit later. Obviously, you heard Eric Raymond's voice there, as well as Russ Pavlicek. Russ, how are you doing out in D.C. today?
Oh, we're just having a wonderful time here. It's actually cool and reasonably calm after a bunch of rain that we had. But outside of that, things are just kind of perking along, and we're perking along with it.
Well, that's good. Well, Kevin and I appear to be all set to go. We do have a server in the NOC that the people in Chicago called me just before the show and said that one of our servers is howling, and so it is very possible that we may be dropping some streams tonight because it is one of our streaming servers that's making the noise. It's not K2, Kevin. Just I don't want to worry you.
Okay.
One of our newer servers, Rhodey 2, is making some kind of really weird and bizarre noise. But we'll persevere. We'll keep going forward and see if we can bring this thing in without being too much of a train wreck.
The server, a cooling fan.
No, this the noise they were describing was not a cooling fan.
Oh, hard drive. Oh, dear.
Yeah, well, something more probably akin to a hard drive bearing. So.
Actually, it's probably a Microsoft software salesman who had been installed inside who has now realized he's getting no commissions ever out of this.
Could be.
I can hear the screaming from here.
Well, let's go ahead and jump in on segment number two. We do want to apologize to all the listeners in advance. I'm a little bit disorganized right at the moment because normally all of my notes are actually hidden away on our website, and I don't have internet access. I have maybe about 1K worth of throughput, so every once in a while I can send a little dirt, a word or two to the IRC, but I cannot get a browser connection to the internet for the life of me. So we just have to sort of fake it and go along, and so we're just going to have to sort of hand the ball off to people back and forth, and you guys are going to have to key yourselves for tonight's show. So I'm going to go ahead to you, Russ. Why don't you start off, because I know a lot of the stories on the link list were yours this evening, so go ahead and start on up.
All right. As Jeff said, you can find these links out on the Linux Show website. Got them. I have all mine up there tonight. So, first one is actually from eWeek, and eWeek is one of those interesting publications that sometimes does some really good work, and sometimes does a little bit less than good work. But this is an interesting piece about Wall Street adopt. It says Wall Street adopts new technology, and this is one of those things that. You know, those of us who have been inside the open source world for some time are aware, has happened as an undercurrent, that there has actually been quite a bit of motion, open source-wise, in the Wall Street world. However, these corporations tend to view the stuff that they're doing as part of their competitive advantage, so they don't talk about it a whole lot. So it's actually nice to see a piece like this, which for me particularly is no big surprise, but it's one of those pieces that is worth showing to people who are still trying to naysay the role of Linux in the enterprise particularly, because this talks about how in the investment banking world and so forth, open source is a big issue, and it truly is a big issue, but they're not issuing press releases by and large. They're not shouting it from the housetops because it's to their advantage to just shut up and get the advantage for themselves. But there's actually quite a bit of competition out there among many of the financial houses, and so if you have a boss or a compatriot who doesn't believe that Linux has a place in the enterprise, show them this piece. Just remind them of the fact that some of the biggest, most aggressive companies when it comes to finance have been working with Linux for a long time and are putting a tremendous amount of focus on it even now.
Yeah, well, there's really two reasons why they're not talking about. One you stated, and I completely agree with you, there's a lot of competitive nature to the people on Wall Street, so no one would divulge what one company is doing versus another company because it may mean a fraction of a 1% edge for one trading house or another. So there's that, but there's also the issue of security. No one talks much in the financial districts what people are using because it's too much of a risk. And so I'm surprised that there's talk of this at all, just from the security standpoint, that traditionally they don't talk about what they're using. So it's pretty interesting that this is starting to come out.
Yeah, and
we've seen glimmerings of this for the better part of a year or two, and you'll hear about one bank or one financial house adopting Linux as a platform for a variety of functions. And another thing that's driving this is the fact that financial houses use Big Iron, and Big Iron is IBM has moved Big Iron definitely into the Linux sphere. And that is also helping.
Yeah, a lot of old Unix users out there too.
That's true.
So there's really no resistance from their legacy application standpoint to migrate to IBM Mini or an IBM mainframe or anything like.
Many of them port without any problem, without any changes.
I had lunch with a venture capitalist today, and he showed me some slides from a presentation that he put together that puts this into perspective. What he did was he put together figures on server sales by unit and server sales by dollar volume, and then he had a figure showing the ratio between those two numbers, which suggested what the average cost of the hardware was. And and Linux had an advantage on that chart of over 1,000 to 1 over proprietary systems other than Unix, and 7 to 1 versus Microsoft, and something like 20 to 1 versus proprietary Unixes. So that number, that tells you what's driving the financial houses.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's real simple dollars and cents issue.
But the total cost of ownership of Windows is lower than the total cost of ownership of Linux.
Yeah, pull the other one. It's got bells on.
Well, since we're in a comic mood, let me go to the next story. And the next story is a piece over at InfoWorld, which when I tried to bring it up just a couple of minutes ago, was slow as a slug. Your mileage may vary. But it's a piece called Sun Considers GPL License for Solaris. And this is one of those pieces that, I kind of read it and I shake my head because it's talking about some of the takes by Jonathan Schwartz, who's president and COO, I guess it is, of Sun these days. And he makes just some very colorful statements.
Let's put it this way. He was thrashing in public.
That's pretty damn close. I mean, there are just some statements in here like this quote: "What worries us about the GPL is its capacity to encourage forking, because that's what happened in Linux, is that Red Hat has forked. Not in the sense that the kernel is different. It forked because if you write to Red Hat distribution, you can't go run on Debian. So therefore, the solution, obviously, is to use Solaris." Which, right.
Which is definitely a fork of Unix.
Yeah, well.
Call for the clue stick.
But there's just a number of different things about maybe we'll GPL it regarding Solaris. We're still looking at where's that, he says.
Or maybe I'll just sit here and whine, we need a strategy. Somebody please give us a strategy.
You know, the other interesting thing is the very interesting little subtopic that InfoWorld gives. It says, hopes to step up competition with Red Hat. And it's kind of interesting that this is the state of Sun Microsystems these days, I gather, that they're hoping to compete with Red Hat. That's a bit of a change from, about 3 years ago when they were riding high inside the server world. Now they're hoping to compete with Red Hat.
It has a fraction of their market capitalization.
Yeah, so it's a very strange little piece. It's worth reading.
Got a lot more profit.
It's worth reading. It's worth reading with a beer in your hand, actually.
Yeah. It is an interesting story. There's another story that's on the list tonight. Linux with an attitude. This is one of those new, what would they call it, O'Reilly Media? Is that what you called it, Eric?
Yes, they've changed their name.
It's one of these new O'Reilly Media stories. Andy Oram penned it. Don't have internet access, so I can't remember the story very well completely, but he was obviously following the same press releases as Bob McMillan at IDG was for his InfoWorld stories, because a lot of the quotes are similar in the Schwartz rantings, in particular about I think that forking thing is just hilarious. I love when people from Sun start making these kind of comments. As a completely 100% related side issue, and I did say related, not unrelated, I did this past week send off a number of contacts, both email, phone calls, written letters to various people, including Mr. Schwartz about coming on the Linux show to talk to Eric. After the show was winding down last week, we were sort of chatting after the show, and Eric said he would be interested in having a conversation with these folks. So I'm trying to arrange it for you, Eric.
Yeah, I mean, I really do not want to believe that Jonathan Schwartz is as much of a fool as he sounds like. I would like him to convince me otherwise.
Yeah, well, the offer has been laid down, and it remains to be seen if they can actually talk him into it. This is one of those, you know, don't hold your breath type of situations. But we'll see. We'll see. There are a lot of people within Sun who are legitimately trying their best to move Sun closer to the open source community. They're trying, but you know, it's like you said last week, Eric. They're mired in the middle of a cultural war within their own company, and they've got to decide what they want to be first before they can move closer to any community. They have to decide what they want to be.
Also, we have to understand that a company the size of Sun, well, any company the size of Sun is not going to be a monolithic thing. And what one person says, no matter what one person near the top might say, what's going on underneath between the sheets is liable to be something entirely different.
Yeah, but things that the president and the COO say do count. They really,
yeah, they do, but
they count. It's not, there's no get out of jail free card on the things that Schwartz has been spouting. He's got to come clean on what's going on with this company. He really does.
May the Schwartz be with you.
Yes, absolutely. So, Russ, what's your next theme this evening?
Okay, there's a piece out there. It says, Industry Pulse Survey shows open source is becoming part of mainstream IT strategy. Yeah, but then again, this is interesting because, once again, believe it or not, there are people in high places in various businesses that still hold to the notion that Linux is not ready for the enterprise, blah, 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 blah. This is a very interesting piece.
And I predict that they're going to hold on to that notion until our market share is at around 90%,
or more
at which point they'll all discover that they believed in Linux 4 years ago.
That's it. Hey, it's worked so many times before, what can we say? The interesting thing here that I find is that, you know, the assessment of what's highly mature and medium mature and what's, you know, immature is about what I kind of expected to hear. But the interesting thing is a few statements like only 13% of respondents do not include open source in their strategy. You know, you talk about mainstream, and when you're starting to get down into single digits of respondents who are not dealing with a particular issue, you know, you're talking about something incredibly major. You know, so the people who are still holding on blindly to this notion that that Linux and business somehow don't mix, surprise, it does. But, you know, a lot of these things that's in here are about what I would expect for an IT survey. Frankly, I think it's, from what little is given here on this page, it seems a lot more balanced than some of the goofy numbers that have been generated with strange funds from the Greater Northwest. And so I think it's a little bit more balanced. Also, it's kind of interesting that it's coming out of Canada. You know, I don't know exactly what that means, but hey. It seems like the Canadians are at least honest, which is a good thing.
It talks to the French list.
it's an interesting little piece. Once again, nice to shove under the nose of your boss if you're having troubles in this area.
Okay. Any other stories?
Yep. One last one, and this is kind of the the community piece of the bunch. From over at Corrosion,
my favorite sites.
Yeah, this is a little rant piece, which frankly is just it's one of those things that's worth thinking about. It's one of those things that we should be thinking about. And it's the author is Pongo, and he's talking about how he was a co-admin for a project that has been not dormant, but it's apparently been relatively slow moving of late. And lo and behold, it apparently got hijacked by one of the other co-administrators, and suddenly everyone who was on the team is off the team, and there's a whole bunch of people on the team that don't know anything about the project or something like that. And he kind of talks about how he tried to do a reasonable resolution with the folks at SourceForge where it was being hosted, and about some of the issues that he had there, that the things that were happening did not seem to mesh with what we really need as a community. So this is just one of those pieces that is worth. Yeah, it's a very short little piece, but it's worth reading, it's worth thinking about, and checking out the discussion that's attached to it, because, you know, it's one of those things where it sort of raises the question of, you know, can we really trust, inside some sense, sites like SourceForge that, you know, have their own reason for being, so forth, will they continue to do the right thing for the community?
I don't think it's exactly a trust issue. I've read this story. It's more a neglect issue. Can you get them to wake up and pay attention?
Right. Yeah. But it is, you know, it's one of those things of who's watching what.
Who's responsible?
Yeah. And you know, what should we be doing? So it's one of those pieces that is definitely worthwhile to stimulate thinking, I believe.
I just don't like the way SourceForge does downloads. Yeah, I
think that's why a lot of people host their project there, but not their download.
Yeah. I mean, I understand where they want to do the load balancing and stuff, which is nice. But there's, I think, a better way to implement the user interface. I don't want it to start. I don't like my computer starting downloads by itself. I want to be able to say, this is where I want it. And, you know, this is when I want it.
Okay, is that it?
That's my group for the night.
Okay, let's go ahead and jump on over to you, Arnie.
Yeah, I got a few here. These are kind of interesting. The first link, and they just went up on the site now, is called Major Vendors Are Positioning Linux as an Alternative for High-End Systems. And this is a surprisingly technical article from USA Today. Apparently, it's bylined by Michael Hardy at fcw.com. I have to yet to go over there to see what that is about. But this is about supercomputing in Linux, and it is a in-depth article. It is quite technical for USA Today, and basically they're talking about high-performance computing clusters. And one of the things they're coming out with on this is that Windows licensing gets very expensive very quickly when you're licensing mini CPUs. And this they quoted Jonathan Eunice, president and principal analyst of Illuminata Incorporated. They do talk about the limit. This is a very well-balanced article. They talk about limits in the 2.6 kernel and some of the things that will need to be addressed to scale for the future. They're talking about in 10 years there being machines with tens of thousands of CPUs, and of course they say that Linux won't scale to that. And, you know, the question is, the problem is that probably nothing scales to that right now. But they also, their tagline is good. There isn't anything else for supercomputing right now at the extreme edge, and Linux is the thing because of that. So that's a good article. Links on the website. Second one is a straight piece of advocacy, which has an interesting tag on it. It's called The Importance of Linux. It's on linux.com. not sure who wrote it. Anyway, it's someone who's an author of Linux books and who is helped writing the Advanced Unix Programming book, which is a legendary book from AT&T. And one of the things that it's just basically a straight advocacy piece claiming that Linux has achieved critical mass and Walmart sells computers with Linux. But what's interesting is that they have a contest. If you want to win a copy, a first edition of the Advanced Unix Programming, published in 1985, Addison Wesley will award the first 19 respondents, one book for each intervening year, who correctly answer three questions about that issue. So people out there in Linux today, in Linux show land, get busy with your old book and answer the three questions and get yourself a first edition copy. Interesting article. Next article is Africans Open Source Projects Gather Steam. And this is interesting, coming out of the Desktop Linux Summit a week ago. And then this is right out of South Africa. There's a new variant of Linux called MP2, which is a upgrade of MP1. And MP1 was based on Debian, and MP2 has a new base, including a new package management system that utilizes XML, which is interesting. And while the earlier version just used GNOME, the new version will support both either GNOME or KDE. And it also has Africa France and Kiswahili spell checkers in both OpenOffice and Mozilla, which are both supposed to work on the fly, which is really, really kind of interesting, because we know that Linux has probably the best internationalization effort of any operating system. And that's good news to this kind of thing happening.
Yeah, 2005, I think the big buzzword for 2005 is going to be localization. I think that's going to be a big battleground.
Yeah, I think so, too. And you know, everything at the Desktop Linux Summit was speaking to internationalization being important, because basically this is where Linux is really, really, really flying, is outside the United States. And people are talking about it all over Europe and all over the other continents. And except for the United States, where, you know, business is very conservative. The next article, Routers Face Open Source Threat, is from the Motley Fool site, and this is really cool. XORP, X-O-R-P, is an IP router project which is going open source. It's sponsored by the International Computer Science Institute, you know, which is affiliated with University of California, Berkeley. And this is an extensible open router platform, XORP. And this is supposed to have a significant impact on market share for mid-sized and mid-firms, mid-sized firms to small firms in routing business, and should have an impact on Cisco and the other people who make their money doing that.
Cisco is not going to like this.
But this is
this is putting it mildly.
Yeah, this is good. Well, I mean, you know, Linux has always played around with routing, but this is actually a project to just basically turn it all over. And Motley Fool is predicting that they will take over significant market share within the niche market, which is kind of interesting. Let's see. There's an interesting article from the New York Times, how John Doerr, the old prospector, finally struck Google. It's a very long article. It's only peripherally connected to Linux. They talk about Google. And this is about venture capitalists and something maybe Eric would really want to comment on. And this is the outfit that has invested $12 million in LinuxCare and is doing some other things. Well, he said a few things in here that's interesting. He said that the 1990s boom was underhyped. just interesting.
Underhyped.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Well,
yeah.
I tell you, I know a lot of people think I'm wacky. There are more and more economists who are starting to relook at the contentions that are being made by some people, me being one of them, that a good percentage of the dot-com bust and the recession were due to manipulation of the internet by the telcos and the MSOs, the cable companies, and that had the critical mass been achieved on the time frame that people were predicting in the mid-90s, this market could very well have been underhyped.
Yeah.
It could very well have been.
I'm sure that's something that could be argued. Another thing interesting in conjunction with LinuxCare is, and this is hard to read what he means here, and I'm just going to read it right out of the article. It also has invested $12 million in LinuxCare, a company that provides support to enterprises using Linux, the operating system that is distributed free. And then he says, quote, "That's a freight train I wouldn't want to get in front of," said Mr. Doerr, explaining the importance of having a stake in a Linux-based venture. "Probably get run over." I think he's talking about Linux in general, not just LinuxCare, but I agree that that's a freight train you don't want to get.
He's padding his own investment, one of the two.
Yeah.
doesn't make a lot of sense.
No, it doesn't. And then he talks about Google being possibly replaced by the next technology, but he says, "I've got a new search in my office that will take on Google." That's Timothy Draper, says that he's got another search office that will take on Google. But I think Google's fairly entranced. He says it's the only company that prospered through the bust. And around the time Walt Disney was completing its acquisition of InfoSeek, he acquired a minority stake in a deal valued at $420 million, and that project was abandoned in 2001. And of course, the week wouldn't be complete without a clueless pundit of the week, and this time it's a clueless CEO of the week again. Dan O'Dowd is at it again. Green Hill Software has now released a third white paper, "Linux Security Unfit for Retrofit," and in a press release dated yesterday and available on the Elixir website, Dan O'Dowd, "There's widespread misconception that open source software inherently provides better security than blah, 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 blah. Lots of soft claims here, no numbers, no links to back it up. It's just lots of soft claims and GPL FUD. He says that the license requires defense contractors to publish the source code of the operating system for any critical defense system that uses Linux. My goodness. Where do these guys get their ideas? And here's the one that really takes the cake. Quote, "Every principle of security is being violated to enable Linux to spread through our defense systems. This must not be allowed to continue," unquote.
It's going to pollute our vital bodily fluids.
Yes. You know why I drink only grain alcohol and only rainwater? That's why. Shades of Dr. Strangelove.
Indeed.
I think we ought to give Dan O'Dowd the Dr. Strangelove Award of the Week.
Here.
A new award.
Clueless nuclear punditry. Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. So, read about it on the Elixir, LXER.com site.
I got a couple things I'd like to throw out for just to get people's opinions on before we take a break and bring in segment number two. We're going to have in segment number two a guest from Win for Lynn, talking about Win for Lynn. Actually, it's Net Travers, not the company isn't Win for Lynn, but Jim Curtin from Net Travers will be joining us in segment number two. But let's spread a couple of more quickies just to get people's opinions on some of the hot issues of the day. First one I'd like to throw out is asking people about the Sasserworm. I'm shocked, and maybe I shouldn't be, but I am shocked at the input the Sasser worm had today. How long have we had of a warning of this thing? What has it been, a month?
How is it hitting? I'm not seeing anything on my email server.
You're not hearing about it? Man,
I've heard about it, but I've not seen it.
Okay, there's a reason it won't show up in your email. It doesn't propagate by email.
Okay.
Instead, it exploits port vulnerability.
Oh, okay.
That's the kind of virus that, well, it's not too bad for us, actually. Doesn't flood our mailboxes, does make people disgusted with Microsoft. It's all good.
Yeah, but it takes out systems big time.
Well, you know what their background choice was.
Yeah.
They were asking to be destroyed.
Well, that's true. But I'm just shocked from the standpoint that this is a relatively simple virus to contend with that I've known about it, I think, for a solid month. And I just cannot believe the number of businesses in Chicago, and not only just the sheer number of businesses, but some really high-profile companies. ABC here in Chicago got completely shut down. All day long. And, so being part of the Disney company, maybe we sort of enjoy watching them get shut down. But that's beside the point. I'm just a little bit shocked. I was wondering if other people had an opinion.
What's the vulnerability, Jeff?
It's like Eric said. It's just a port vulnerability.
IIS?
Hmm?
Is it IIS or...?
Yeah, that's one of the potential ports, yes. But it's easily pluggable. So, well, if you don't have much of an opinion on that, how about this one? How about the efforts by Apple to shut down a number of open source projects for free audio file players that make use of the Apple iPod music files? Any feelings on that? There's a number of stories out on the internet today about that. One up on our website from IDG.
I'd like to have an iPod, but
if you can't,
if I can't use it with Linux, with software on Linux, what good is it?
Yeah, well, yeah. Shouldn't you be allowed to buy those songs from Apple and then play them on your PC running Linux?
Well, I mean, yeah, if they had songs I want.
Well, Apple says no.
Well, I mean, you know, if I buy a song, it's mine. I can do with it what I please.
You can play it on your iPod or you can play it on your Windows computer. But not.
Well, I don't. Or I can get the DLL and play it on MPlayer. Maybe. I don't know if they have a driver, but I imagine they'll will soon.
Yeah, I think this is a little...
Maybe we can play it on Win4Lin.
you probably would be able to. But I think this is perhaps something that we really need to keep an eye on out of Apple, because Apple seems, as much as they have cozied up to the open source community, they're very, very DRM-focused. And I think it's something that we need to be smart about. I was a little bit shocked when I, discovered that they have already shut down a number of Linux projects, and they have plans on continuing this effort in the future. Well, that's all I have for tonight. Just a couple of quickies just to get your opinions on. But you guys,
well, my opinion about that is that kind of behavior is its own punishment.
It will be in the long run. Because I think what Apple's doing is they've got to get a near ironclad monopoly in this space, and they're going to piss people off.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to lose their monopoly because they're going to piss people off.
Very likely.
And I'm a little shocked by the closed-minded attitude of what is normally a very smart company. Well, let's take a break, everybody. Kick back, relax. Kevin, put a tune on. We'll come back in about 2 or 3 minutes with segment number 2 of the Linux Show for May the 2nd. No, 4th of 2004. Hang in there, everybody. We'll be right back.
And we're back.
It's the Wittig Show for May the 4th, 2004, segment number two. We are talking to Jim Curtin of NetTravers. Jim is the president, CEO, chief cook and bottle washer of NetTravers, and he's joining us tonight to talk about Win for Lynn. Arnie and Doc ran into Jim at the desktop Linux conference a couple of weeks back. Is that not correct, Arnie?
Yeah.
And suggested that we give him a holler and invite him on the show. We had an opening that popped up right away, and so Jim has jumped into it. So, Jim, welcome to the Linux Show.
Thanks. My good fortune for whoever the unlucky soul was who dropped off. Thank you for thinking of me.
Well, it's not a problem. You were in the right place at the right time, and that's always fortunate.
That's a great time for Win for Lynn.
Yeah, it is. It's a good outcome for you. Yeah. Could you start out, first of all, by just telling us a little bit of background about, you know, the company. What were the motivations behind starting the company? What were the motivations behind targeting that particular product? And then I've got a whole slew of questions about the way Win for Lynn is actually being deployed by users. So.
Sure. Well, the history is actually quite old. There was a company in San Diego called Locus Computing way back when. In about 85, they did something called DOS for System 5, and it was called Merge. And I happened to enter a relationship with another company around 97. My company at that time was called Dascom, and we did security products. IBM ended up buying the company. But this was a secure node for the military, which was a Unix node with multi-level windowing systems. Of course, the Windows system was done by this technology Merge. Well, around that time, we saw Linux coming up, and we thought we'd buy this product off of Locus and start a whole new company. And then IBM bought my company, and I bought the subsidiary back from IBM, and we launched it as Netravers. And we saw the opportunity for a bridge from the Windows world to the Linux world right away. And so that was the whole intent, was to bring this Unix-based product, which ran Windows on Unix, over to the Linux side, because all the stars were seeming to align with the low-cost offering in the Linux space and the need to bring as many users over as possible and make the migration as pain-free as possible. So that was really the motivation behind starting it. We took a Unix-based product, we bought it, we moved it over to Linux, and we've been promoting it as a solid bridge ever since.
Okay. Now, I'm not totally 100% clear as to how someone would deploy the product. It's been described to me a couple of times by Doc and some other people. But let me give you a brief comment. You tell me if I'm right or wrong. But you've got a Linux machine, and that Linux machine has Win for Lynn running on it almost as a middleware application. And then you've got an incident of Windows running on top of the Win for Lynn, is that correct?
Yeah, effectively you install Win for Lynn into the Linux system, and it sits in the Linux file system. And then when you fire it up, it is a Linux process, and all of your Windows applications run in that Linux process. It's effectively running a copy of Windows in a Linux process integrated into the file system. It runs in shared memory, the caching, the task scheduling, all controlled by Linux. So it's a very good Linux citizen in the sense that it actually resides in the Linux file system. So it's a Linux process. It turns a Windows desktop environment and makes it able to run in the Linux process.
So when a user is actually running an application with a Windows application with Win for Lynn, where is the file going?
Into the Linux file system. There's something we have, there's a Win directory we call in the Linux file system, and all of the my documents and the Win system folders and all that stuff are actually in the Linux file system in a directory called Win.
And are those files stored as MTFS, FAT?
No, they're just straight Linux file system files.
Yeah.
there, it's not NTFS, there's no conversion. It is native. We do some redirection in the writes so that it writes actually to the Linux file system. So we're a device driver level technology. That's kind of effectively what we do, as opposed to emulation or virtualization. We heavily rely on the device driver model to achieve the performance and the stability, and as well as the broad fidelity of the application experience.
Okay, so my next logical question stemming from that is, then a user who is going to make use of Win4Lin is still going to have a Windows license on that machine.
Yes, absolutely. So you're currently a Windows user. You want to be a Linux user. You rehost your Windows environment as a guest in your Linux environment. And effectively, it's like a methadone clinic, if you will. We're weaning you off of the Windows.
Okay. So from a standpoint of... Okay, I want to get this picture clear in my mind, because I'm sure a lot of other people are going to have the same image that they're going to be trying to paint to somebody about your product. So this would very, very, very specifically be a conversion product from an existing batch of existing Windows license keys.
Yes.
This is not something you would do as a competitive product, go head-to-head with new Linux.
Absolutely not. This is our point is, if you don't have Windows now, why have it at all?
Yeah.
You know, in other words, this is positioned toward the person that's got Windows software that he has to run, and he wants to try Linux, but he has no way to run it.
Right. Or even more to the point, what we really serve is the market that's very sold on Linux desktop, and they get about 80% of their business functionality out of Linux desktop. It's that other 20% that we cater to. We wholly espouse, you know, people running OpenOffice and Mozilla and all of the native applications where they exist. It's the other 20%. And my presentation the other day was 20% of the functionality is 80% of the problem, because you've got this big spike in email browsing and Office productivity stuff where 80% of the functionality is there. But the other 20% is like this tail that stretches a mile long of hundreds of thousands of applications which have, you know, 1,000 users or 10,000 users or whatever, but there's no business case whatsoever to go and rush in and make a native Linux application for, say, building inspection software or even TurboTax, which refreshes every year. So we're there for that niche third-party Visual Basic, Visual Studio, whatever it happens to be, those niche things that you can't make a business case for replacing natively in Linux yet.
That company-specific custom database implemented in Access.
Exactly. I had some guy come up to me at the show with a DOS disk that's 15 years old. He just popped in and it worked. You know,
wow.
The guy was, you know...
That's impressive.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. We didn't have to do a thing. We just popped it in and it worked.
You mean some lady came
in with an embroidery application.
Hold a minute. You mean to tell me that you actually had 5 1/4-inch drive on site?
No. What we did was we told the guy the first day, said, you know, if you can put your application on a CD, we'll load it in. So he went home, he copied the whole thing over to a CD, brought it in, we popped the CD in, and the thing just worked.
Okay, now I believe you.
Okay. Yeah, well, there was a step in there for brevity, which I skipped. But you know, that's the whole point is really that, you know, 20% of the functionality. We're trying to, I mean, there's a middle step here, guys, that the market just doesn't, I mean, you know, the faithful just doesn't want to admit is necessary. You can't go from zero to native applications across the whole spectrum of what people do. And so, you know, a bridging phase, we can, a nice, sturdy, broad bridge, we can bring people over en masse to create a big enough market of the Linux desktop so that now the application, you know, the ISVs have something to whet their appetites. And that phase of bridging people over and having them, you know, at the user level, still use Windows for a while, whereas at the operational level, you're getting all the efficiencies of Linux, and then gradually it's like the frog in the pot. You just boil them slow, and pretty soon they're running all Linux, and they don't even know it.
Right now, Win4Lin supports the 16-bit versions of Windows, Windows 95, 98, and ME.
Correct.
How far are we from having... WinNT XP?
We're not going to do NT. We're doing, of course, the NT family, but we're going to jump in at Windows 2000. We already have the kernel booting. We're expecting to have a beta out in October and a GA at the end of the year. If we can get something with a heartbeat, you know, like the display module, we'll do that in an alpha stage in the summer.
So, let's back up one step here. So, are you fully supporting the bunking process of Win98?
I missed a part. I could repeat that.
Are you fully supporting the funking, T-H-U-N-K-I-N-G, funking process of the Win98 kernel?
You might have to explain that to me. I skipped that one because I've heard that talked about a number of times by my engineers.
Okay, well, there's actually two separate kernels within Win98 SE.
Mm-hmm.
There's a 16-bit kernel and a 32-bit kernel.
Yeah, we support the 32-bit, and we support the full Windows 98 SE and the ME. So, yeah, I could get a better answer for you, but right now I'm not really sure.
What we'd like to know is if Win for Lin thunks.
Yeah, I got it. I'll get back to you on that one.
If it doesn't, then you need to put out a sales brochure saying, Win for Lin don't thunk.
I assume thunking is a good thing.
No, thunking is a bad thing.
Well,
okay.
No, Arnie, that's not true. Thunking is what made Win98 compatible with legacy DOS software.
That's true.
So it was a good thing when it came out. It's one of the core problematic reasons why Windows operating systems crash so much.
Mm.
That's why in Win 2000, it don't thunk.
Right. Well, I mean, one of the things we find when people first use Win for Lin is that they write to us and say, hey, it doesn't crash anymore. Because we're using the Linux network stack and because we're actually under the covers seeing what it's trying to do at the kernel level, and we usually give it back the right answer that Microsoft didn't bother to do with Windows 98. So we have a lot more stability because, as I said, we're seeing what it's trying to do. We see when it's going to create a conflict. We actually pass back a message that's not going to create a conflict. So we've done for Windows 98 with Win for Lin what they've done with Windows 2000. But it's hard to sell. You know, I mean, people don't want to hear that. So that's why we're going to Windows 2000. But plus, you know, half the market today is on Windows 2000. So that's the other reason we're going there. We're trying to, you know, Windows XP is a downbeat. You know, Longhorn's going to be the next big adoption. So we're trying to get the Win9X family plus the 2000 family and cut them off and herd them into a different direction towards Linux and web services and a more open network, less leveraged future.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah. Well, I just want more people to get on the bandwagon here because, like I said, we were in a free fire zone for a while between Linux and Microsoft, and now it's turned into a DMZ where, you know, the users are saying, look, I like Linux. I want it to work. I want some coexistence. I want some compatibility. So the users are starting just barely to assert themselves, and that's a nice part of the market phase when users come in and ask for interoperability or cross-platform integration. And I think that's where our role, you know, that's where we'll really shine.
All right. I'm a company that's got 5,000 Windows boxes.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to convert them all to Linux with Win for Lin.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of licensing is that going to involve?
Well, what you would do, ideal recommendation would be to take all those licenses off the desktop, rehost them on a Linux server in our Win for Lin terminal server product. And that way you put Linux on the desktop, you get Linux on the server, so you get an end-to-end footprint where Microsoft is a guest in that environment, but off the server. So as you gradually implement changes and ultimately decommission Windows, you can do that from a central standpoint. The cost, you know, if you're asking the cost, that's the architectural approach would advise, you know, which would be the most labor-effective and cost-effective. Our list price is $125 a seat for the server version, and we obviously do volume discounts, and we are at a phase here where we're also bartering off for good references, so there's deals to be had, and $5,000 would be a nice cherry, so we would do something for that. But that's the approach. We would obviously recommend hosting your Windows resources on a Linux server so they could be better maintained to change the lower cost, et cetera, and then push them down to Linux-based desktops.
There's a lot of medium-sized companies in that very space.
Oh, yeah.
Where they have a few hundred to low thousand Windows desktops. And
the beautiful thing about that, too, Linux can really motor on those low-end desktops, whereas Windows is such a hog, you have to upgrade all the hardware. If you move your Windows state off the desktop and you put it on a server, you've effectively broken the hardware upgrade cycle, because Linux can move just fine on that low-end desktop. So it's another savings that Linux can, you know, bring to the table.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was going to ask you about next. That's all very well and good. I really love terminal servers for their efficiency and scalability in large companies. But the average company in the United States right now has something like, what is it, 6.7 employees? And so, you know, it's 7 desktops within the company. Obviously, they wouldn't go that direction. They would go, you know, individual licenses.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's too bad we had this whole kind of doldrums here the last 3.5 years. But, you know, the world was moving towards an ASP model. And one of the reasons, you know, we also founded at the time was to try to get, you know, small business IT services outsourced.
I have to dispute something you just said.
Mm-hmm.
You say the world is moving towards an ASP model?
No,
we've heard this song before.
It was, I said.
Huh?
I said in 2000 it was.
Oh, it was moving. Ah.
Yeah.
It is.
That was the what I said. We hit the doldrums and that whole thing died.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so what I'm saying is we started with that vision in 2000, but I still think it's relevant at some point when the wind picks up again and we look at different architectural models and how to lower costs and
it
still
deliver value. It will never happen, and I can tell you why.
Please.
Not for technical reasons, but for psychological ones. Managers are control freaks, and they fundamentally don't feel safe unless they can put their hands on the hardware where the data is.
I agree, but, you know, it's the same argument could be made in 1994 about putting credit cards on the Internet. And then by 97, you know, everyone in the world already had. So perceptions change once there's a comfort feel. And what we talk about doing is starting with task-based workers. The last thing they want to do is take their computers home or care where the data is. They just want to input their forms. They want to, you know, write their letters. They want to do their things. And you don't go for me and you and the white-collar world that's running around with laptops. And, yeah, I'm the control freak you're talking about. I'm not ready to do that. But there's a segment of my, you know, hypothetical company where you would say you people are moving to this model because it's going to save us 25%.
Right. But the difference is it sounds to me like your model is to assist deployments of that kind of centralization within companies. That I believe because it gives the managers at those companies more control. What I don't believe is companies outsourcing their storage and their computers to someone else.
I agree, and that's why even like back in 2000, our, you know, pitch was internal ASP, you know, an enterprise ASP.
Yeah. That's a good model.
And that's where it will start. And then eventually if it catches and people, you know, it depends on the wireless umbrella we're all covered with and the stability of that and people's, you know, comfort levels with disconnectedness of information.
Right.
But, you know, and so it's a process. It might be 15 years, but it's a logical evolution. It's just not going to happen tomorrow.
What are you seeing in your business? You're seeing a lot of overseas business?
Yeah.
We saw a lot of that at the summit, and that was one of the things that I picked up on is that the terminal services in Europe and in third world countries is becoming very, very important.
Right, even in first world countries in Asia, like Japan had a great reference with our product in a school system. Us and, you know, Graphon, of all people, popped up, go global. So, we see that. We have some great references in Italy and in the UK and Japan. But we're also starting to make headway in the States. You're all familiar with the LillyCorp cardiologist thing that's been on Business Week and it's been keynoted here and there. Well, we've signed up with those guys, and they've got us now in the pulmonary care unit because, ironically, what we learned from these guys is that a lot of these verticals, they've built their applications on Win 9.8. There was never any business need to change the application just for the sake of a turn of the operating system. So these guys are on, you know, 7-year-old, applications that now they're concerned about the security because Windows 98 is like Typhoid Mary out there, right?
Yeah.
It can infect your whole network. So they're looking, how do I lift this up and quarantine it, so to speak, without having to invest in reproducing, you know, redundant capabilities. And so it's a cool opportunity to just go out there and lift those applications up, move them off a server, really change the value proposition without having to waste money on new functionality. And you protect the security while you do it. So we're seeing that up in Albany with those folks, and we're excited about that. One of my first customers for this thing, by the way, was AT&T out in Sacramento in their call center, and they bought 300 seats because they had NT, they had Windows 2000, they had Solaris. They put a Red Hat server in the center, and they created a common application environment, which they remote displayed via our stuff to all these heterogeneous clients, and they were able to implement a common application environment across heterogeneous hardware, all off a Linux server. You know, we've been resource constrained, so we can't exploit these as much as I'd like, but that's all starting to change now. We can feel some wind in the sails, but that's a perfect call centers, labs, students, you know, all of these places where people need the hot seat. You know, they need to be able to get to a machine that someone else has been on and not have to deal with the corruption that the previous person inflicted on the machine. So, good stuff.
And it works that well, too.
Absolutely. It's been in production at AT&T for 2 years. This Italian tour operator, 500 users, has been in production a year and a half. German Railway has been in production 2.5 years. That's on a Unix box, though. But, you know, the model is there. It needs a big enough megaphone to get the message out, because Citrix is so dominating that, you know, everyone just assumes that's the only game in town. Even look at Tarantella. I mean, they're really good technology. They're doing like $14 million a year. You know, what's going on there? You had $500 million in Citrix, $600 million, and you got $14 million with the next biggest guy. So we've always tried to go out as a Linux alternative to Citrix, and eventually when we get, like I say, the big enough megaphone, you know, we'll get that message out. Everyone wants a second source, a second alternative to Citrix, because it's, number one, is a stodgy old monolithic architecture where, you know, users' corruptions propagate across the whole system. It's a one big monolithic base. Whereas when you run our terminal server, we're actually little virtualized sandboxes that can't contaminate each other. If one process becomes corrupt in some way, it doesn't infect the others. And so you've got nice isolation, nice performance, nice resource planning. So we think it's a great alternative.
One other question from the IRC. Are there any issues with the 2.6 kernel?
No, we now support for that back in November when the kernel was first stabilized.
Okay, so device driver implementation isn't a factor there.
It was beautiful for us, too, because we were able to fix a lot of things that we were having to implement ourselves that we just got for free out of the 2.6 kernel. So, we have a nice modular architecture that implements really fast with new kernels.
Now, let's just take a hypothetical number here. If I have 100 Windows applications that I am running within my company, are you 100 for 100?
If you're a business application, we do DirectX right now, but we don't do accelerated DirectX because the hardware support in Linux itself is limited. So we have limitations in accelerated DirectX. But, you know, if you're talking something, anything from a Visual Basic application you wrote yourself to a Siebel client to Freelance or Notes or you name it, we run it.
I can tell you one way I've seen it used. I have a friend of mine named Ivan. Hopefully you're out there listening tonight, Ivan. And Ivan uses it to run Microsoft Project on his Linux box.
Mm-hmm.
Because unfortunately, he needs to be able to exchange project files with other people, and Microsoft Project is only compatible with Microsoft Project.
Right.
So this is the compromise that he came up with, is he can still use Linux, and he can still run Project when he absolutely needs to.
I wish I could remember the gentleman's name, but about a month and a half ago, someone at OS News wrote up Winfrey, and Project was one of the applications they picked. They said they just can't get away from. And that was they gave us, like, you know, a shining review because it just worked, and it worked great. And, again, the observation is that it's perceived to run faster because a lot of the file system accesses and the caching in Linux is so snappy that it actually looks like it's running Windows faster than native. We don't say that because, you know, it borders on incredulous, but, you know, your own experience will speak for itself. But that's, you know, I'd say, you know, I'd like to say 100 for 100, and without the games, and in certain USB peripherals, you know, audio recording is a little bit complicated because of direct hardware access. But other than that, you know, any business application, I'd say hundreds of thousands of applications would just work. And I only say hundreds of thousands because I don't want to say millions, and I'm not sure how many actual Windows applications are out there.
Yeah, it'd be tough to peg.
Yeah, I mean, but well, the education industry where they make all these, you know, dinky little knockoff applications, they, you know, they just work.
If you're even doing like 95 out of 100, you're still doing better than Windows does themselves.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's the truth. Well, the other thing is we joke that I think it's the wine guys talk about, you know, they got three gold applications. Well, I mean, we don't have distinctions because every one of ours is gold. You know, it just it has 100% fidelity with no porting, no support, no maintenance. It just works.
Yep.
So it's not a porting toolkit. It's just it's a bridge. So instead of parachuting people in one by one, or just march them across in busloads, you know.
Huh. Well, I will definitely have to load it up and give it a try.
Please do. It was my compliments as well. Please send me a note. We'll take care of you.
Okay. We will definitely do that. Well, it is quarter after the hour, and so it is time to call it a night for this edition of the Linux. So, Jim, we're really glad you could stop by.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
For the show. Glad we didn't miss you when your computer crashed. Glad we were able to put it together. And keep an eye out for us at some of your favorite upcoming Linux and open source conferences. We generally show up, at least about one or two of us show up to most of the conferences. So keep an eye out for us.
Will do. We'd love to have a face-to-face.
We'll say hi when we hook up with you.
Okay.
And to all you folks out there listening, we do appreciate you coming by every week. This has been the Linux Show for May the 4th, 2004. Make sure that you tell everybody that you're a fan of the Linux Show and tell them to stop on by and check us out. The Linux Dailies will hopefully resume. I'm not guaranteeing tomorrow, but they will definitely resume by Thursday. If you haven't been to the Linux Daily Show, we had a little illness problem within the family that has sort of caused a manpower crunch here at the office. So we should be back up to snuff by Thursday, if not by tomorrow. So we'll see everybody next week. Until then, we're out of here.
Thank you.